should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does everyone know the meaning of sadhu? What's that at the end? You know the meaning of sadhu? You know the meaning of sadhu? Yeah? You know Ajahn Brahm's translation of sadhu? Yeah?
Oh, Ajahn Brahm?
Yeah,
right? No.
Yeah. Awesome.
Oh.
Awesome. 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 Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's Ajahn Brahm. It's not so far from the truth, actually. Yeah, no. It's quite good. And if you really understand the meaning of the Metta Sutta, you know it's really awesome. Yes. Okay. Okay. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about meditation practice. Then we'll try some meditation out in the kind of see what how it works, and then we'll give a talk afterwards, something like that. And then the Soka organization at the very end, and a chocolate cake after that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. 8:30. Okay. Yeah. So don't think about the chocolate cake during meditation, right? that is guaranteed not to make the meditation work. So I'm just going to start with the basics. And one of the ways of thinking about meditation practice, of course, is important to be able to relax and to be at ease and all of that. And to be able to do that, sometimes you have to establish the perception in the right way so that the mind actually is led in that direction pretty much by itself. The idea is not to do the meditation so much, but allow the meditation to happen. And one of the ways of doing that, which I think I probably talked about it before, but anyway, let's talk about it again. And that is when you imagine that you come back home after a long day, maybe you had lots of things to do, like going to work, maybe shopping and who knows what, and you feel quite exhausted. I'm sure you have those days sometimes when you feel pretty exhausted. Yeah, everybody has that sometimes. And all you want to do is just sit down. Yeah, so you get a good chair and you just sit down and you kind of just allow things to be and you just relax, yeah, and you don't do anything at all because you feel so exhausted. And that, the way you think, or the way you feel, or the way you are at that particular point, when you sit back in a chair after feeling very exhausted, is in some ways quite similar to what you do in meditation practice. Because when you sit back after a long, exhausting day in a chair, you just allow things to flow. Yeah, you don't do anything, you just allow your mind to kind of babble and do whatever it needs to do and kind of carry on and feel tired and being confused or whatever. You don't try to do anything in particular. You don't try to get rid of the exhaustion. You just sit there feeling it and allowing it to unwind, in a sense. At least that's what I do when I feel really exhausted. I'm sure you probably hope maybe you do the same thing. Yeah. So, and the idea with that, what happens when you don't, you just sit back, you feel your exhaustion, you allow it to be and all of that, what happens is that you feel gradually your energy kind of comes back again, yeah? Gradually the confusion and the problems of the day, all of that kind of dissipates, and slowly, slowly the energy comes back and you start to feel better and you start to feel able to function again and do the things that you have to do, whatever that is. And the reason why that works is because when you just sit back and don't do anything here, you don't have any, you're not using your will, you're not using the doer inside. Always during ordinary life or during ordinary day or whatever you want to call it, we're always applying ourselves, using our willpower to do this, to do that. And then at the end of the day, you feel quite exhausted, yeah, because that using of the willpower, making choices takes a lot of mental energy. I don't know if you notice that, having to decide things, actually it's quite hard sometimes, and it can be quite exhausting. And then now, you're not making any choices whatsoever, you're not using the willpower, you're not trying to be in any way whatsoever, you're just allowing things to unwind, and that is what gets your energy back again. And that is in large part how meditation works as well. You sit back and you try to just you be there in the same way that you as if you come home after work, just allowing things to be, allowing the mind to run whatever the mind wants to do, allow the mind to do that, whatever the body wants to do, allow the body to do that. And as you do that, the energy tends to flow back into the mind again, gradually, and it builds it up, and that energy and that peace and that non-doing that comes from that, that is the kind of thing that we're searching for or looking for in a meditation practice. This is just a skillful means, a way of thinking. It is not exactly the same as coming back after work and sitting down in your favorite armchair and relaxing, because your favorite armchair is kind of really relaxing. Yeah? So you kind of, sometimes you just fall asleep, yeah, or you get really dull or something like that, maybe because it's so nice and comfortable. So here the idea is, instead of falling asleep, we try to instead build up the energy so that we gain mindfulness instead. Yeah, so this is similar, but not exactly the same. It is not quite. This is why we have these chairs here and not armchairs here. Is that right? Is that why we don't have good armchairs? maybe not exactly the reason, but you know, something like that. Because these chairs are a little bit more suitable. They're comfortable, but not kind of, you know, sleeping comfort to them. And that's kind of that middle way again we're talking about in Buddhism. So as you do that, you hopefully, that will give you some idea, some perception of what we're trying to achieve during meditation practice. And then, as your mindfulness hopefully clarifies, yeah, you get energy coming back and all of these kind of things, that is when it becomes possible sometimes to do what we call focusing on a particular object of meditation, like, you know, focusing on the breath or focus on loving kindness or whatever it is. Always we should do, the first thing should always be to to allow mindfulness to arise, because without that mindfulness, focus is really almost impossible, without using willpower, without tiring yourself out even more, and then you are on the right kind of track. So then you use the mindfulness, and then you can go on to these other things. So that is the first part, yeah, of the meditation, allowing the mind to be. And the second part is to always to if we can, and this is often very difficult, especially in daily life, it is easier perhaps when you go on retreat and that sort of thing, but that is to give a little bit of kind of joy to the meditation practice, brighten up your mind a little bit by thinking about something, thinking about a Buddhist theme, if you like, or some theme that elevates the mind, gives it energy and even gives it joy. And there's a number of classical ways of doing that in Buddhism, but one of them is called the Buddha Nusati, which means the recollection of the Buddha, thinking about the Buddha in the right way. And because this is Vesak and we're going to do the Vesak circumambulation today, I thought I might talk a little bit about the Buddha afterwards. It's going to be an extended contemplation of the Buddha, so I'm not going to say too much about it now, but the idea is just to get this feeling for who the Buddha is. Yeah, get a feeling for this man who existed 2,500 years ago, who had this incredible insight into the nature of reality and now shares it with us. And to understand how fortunate we are to have a teacher like that to supply us, to help us, to guide us towards happiness and away from suffering. It is one of the things I like to say about the Buddha. He is the greatest spiritual genius in human history. And this is kind of what is so amazing about him, and so kind of astonishing. And once you get a feeling for that, why that is the case and how it plays out and how it relates to us, it can give a sense of goosebumps. Wow, got this amazing teacher. It's kind of astonishing. So we have to kind of try to approach the Buddha in such a way that we can actually understand that. But sometimes it can be difficult, and the reason it is difficult is because the Buddha is like on a kind of very different level in a sense. It can be hard to fully appreciate where the Buddha, actually very almost impossible to appreciate fully where the Buddha is at. He's reached a kind of higher level. You have to be on that same level yourself really to fully understand, and that takes a lot of meditation before you get there. Prior to that, you can also, as I think I mentioned last time I was here, contemplate more the idea of Kalyanamitta in general. Kalyanamitta is this Pali word which means spiritual friends, or good friends. Mitta is a friend in Pali. Kalyana is like good, good, so good friends. This is another way, because the Buddha is like the number one good friend or spiritual friend. But there are other spiritual friends. There is here in WA or Perth, we have a very strong Buddhist monastic community, which is actually pretty remarkable. When you look around the world, Perth has pretty much the strongest Buddhist monastic community anywhere outside of Asia, almost. It's hard to kind of make direct comparison, but it's close to that. So that is a wonderful resource label to draw on, monk's monastery or nun's monastery, all of these things. And then you have the BSWA, which is a very large spiritual organization with over, I think, almost 1,500 people who keep the five precepts at all times. And then you have the Armada meditation group people coming together, all these people who are there, all these people who wish you well, all these people who want to support you in your practice, everyone kind of working together. It's amazing. And when you think about that, you get this feeling that you have this kind of, you have all these other people who are there, and they are there kind of, this is incredibly important support, because if you haven't got that support and you're all by yourself, it makes the spiritual path incredibly difficult sometimes. We need that support around us, and that is what you have with all of these groups and all of these different venues and all of that. So when you reflect on that, actually, we are all very fortunate, myself included, and everyone, because we have all of these things here. And when you think about that, we get a sense of gratitude, you get a sense of joy, because of that wonderful thing that is there around you to help you and guide you in the right direction. So those are just the two points, and these are two, I think, generally very important points in the meditation practice. The first one, to learn to be passive, to learn to just be sitting back and allowing things to be. And the second one, to give rise to a little bit of joy and happiness in the meditation. If you get these two things right, then bam, your meditation is gonna go really, really well. So now let us try it out in practice and see what happens. Okay. Okay, so start out by just feeling your body for a while. The body becomes very much more clear in awareness when you close your eyes. So just feel the body, making sure you are comfortable. You've been sitting in meditation for about half an hour or so. And start out just by feeling comfortable. And a big and important aspect of the comfort is to feel relaxed and at ease. So make sure at the beginning of your meditation that you let go of any stress you may have, or any tension or whatever it is, and just try to allow to dissipate all of that. Most important thing again is just to sit back and relax and just enjoy and feel as if you are now, you're on this holiday, and all you have to do is sit back and enjoy what is happening here. No need to do anything here, you're just enjoying sitting there on this comfortable chair. please remember that the idea here is to be a passive observer. Your job is not to drive the meditation or do the meditation, but just to be aware, not doing anything in particular. So sit back, and once again, the simile of the passenger on the train is a very nice one. You're just sitting back in your seat and watching the view outside of the window. And whatever the view is, you just accept that. You allow it to be, and you don't try to control it. and see if we can just stay with that awareness, not doing anything, just being passive. And hopefully as you do so, you will gradually see the clarifying of the mind, having more clarity about what is going on, and also more peace as well. And one of the ways of doing this is to notice the peace around us. And as you feel the peace that is here, with so many people sitting quietly together, it starts to grow inside of you. If you can see the beauty, the happiness, the contentment in that, the feeling starts to grow, and you become more peaceful as a consequence. And if you like to give your meditation a little bit more inspiration and profundity, you can try to just reflect very briefly on the how fortunate you are to have so many good spiritual friends, how difficult it is to find the situation in this world, and then have a sense of gratitude for the very fortunate situation you are in. And if you wish, you can just carry on like this, being peaceful and mindful, and just being aware of how things are. That is perfectly okay. Or if you feel ready, you feel you have sufficient clarity, you can also start to do the breath meditation if you want. If you want to watch the breath, make sure you are very gentle and very careful. See the breath as an old friend, not someone to be controlled, but just someone to be associating with and enjoying your time with. And then go forward in meditation with this wonderful friend called the breath. And we are now coming close to the end of the meditation center. And before we come to the very end, just take a couple of moments just to reflect on the process. And if you do feel more at ease and more relaxed than when you started, try to understand why that is the case. How does this process work? So to get an understanding of the process for the future. Any comments or questions or anything anyone would like to say about the meditation practice? Everyone completely satisfied, content? No? Wow, that's pretty amazing. Okay. Okay, great. Nobody wants to say anything? Yeah? No? Is there any question in the box at the back? Or
no
questions in the box at the back. Okay, good. Means I can just talk away. Okay. Okay, good. So I will just start. And as I mentioned just before, when we had the opening here, the idea of Vaisak is, of course, a celebration of the Buddha specifically. And it celebrates all the main aspects of the Buddha's life, his birth, his awakening, and also his eventual death. And all of these things are part of what we celebrate. So it's like a kind of a very big day for most Buddhists around the world. And it is a time to reflect on the meaning of the Buddha. Who is the Buddha? And the idea here is to, if you like, befriend the Buddha a little bit, to make him to somebody we have a closer, more intimate relationship to. And you may think it is strange to have an intimate relationship with someone who lived 2,500 years ago. But actually, this is kind of the point. It is not that strange after all. And one of the reasons why it is not so strange is because we have a large amount of scriptures and a large amount of discourses or talks by the Buddha that he gave 2,500 years ago that we still have in the present day. And when you read those, you actually sometimes you can get the reasonably good feeling for the Buddha as a person, especially if you know where to look. And that is where I come in, because I know where to look, so I can help you out. I can give you some shortcuts on how to kind of look in the right places to understand who the Buddha was. And one of the interesting things about the Buddha that people often underestimate, that in many places in the suttas he comes across as very much an ordinary human being. Yeah, as a human being, it can relate to one-on-one, someone who is kind of one of us in a sense, not as something strange or different, not like a god or some kind of energy in the universe or anything like that, but as a human being. And this is a very useful thing to recognize, because once you see the Buddha as a human being, just like everyone else, his message is far more relevant to us. It's like sitting in the presence of a teacher, who is also human, and then having a conversation, and there is always going to be a mutual understanding when you're talking to someone who is very similar to you. And this is kind of one of the important points about understanding the Buddha. And just to give you some examples from the sutta, there's one sutta is a discourse, it's a kind of an occasion when the Buddha gives a teaching to somebody. And there's one occasion where one of the very famous kings at the time of the Buddha, called King Pasenadi, he was a king of a large kingdom called the Kosala country, and he was a very well-known disciple of the Buddha at that time. And one day he comes to the Buddha, and he comes in the middle of the day, and you're not supposed to come to the Buddha in the middle of the day. So the Buddha says to him, "Why are you coming in the middle of the day?" Yeah, something like that. And then the king is kind of huffing and puffing away, and the Buddha sees straight away that he has been eating too much. And then the Buddha says to him, "I will give you some advice on how to lose weight, yeah, because you're eating too much. You know, you're huffing and puffing away. You're kind of gaining too much weight. I'll give you some advice on how to lose weight." And then the Buddha gives him advice on how to lose weight. Yeah, this is what he does in this particular sutta. And it's like a little verse, and this verse is supposed to be repeated, yeah, whenever he has a meal, so it reminds him of kind of eating to the right amount and all these kind of things. That is kind of amazing, yeah. He's a great spiritual genius in human history, and he gives advice on how to lose weight to one of the local kings. It's very human, yeah. It's very direct. It's the kind of thing that we might ask people for. Maybe perhaps not the spiritual genius, but it shows you how the connection with the Buddha and the people around him was a very close one. It was a thing where you kind of had ordinary conversations with somebody about ordinary things. I'm not going to tell you the verse. The reason is because I can tell you that maybe next time. Make sure you come back next time. It's interesting. What does the Buddha have to say about losing weight? It's kind of interesting. Yeah, it's kind of wow. What you know? Because it's very profound. Yeah, if he has something to say about this. Anyway, I'll leave that out for now because to be honest with you, I can't even remember exactly what he said. So that makes it hard. So this is one example. Another example is exactly the same. King Pasenadi, of course, and now also coming to the Buddha. In this case, he sits down in front of the Buddha, and as the Buddha is talking to him, a man, one of his attendants, comes up to the king from behind, and he whispers something into the king's ear. And then when this man has finished his whispering into the king's ear, the king looks really sad and glum and downcast. Yeah, and the Buddha sees this, and the Buddha asks, "Well, what's wrong? You know, what's happening here?" And then the king says to the Buddha, he says that, "Well, this attendant of mine, he just told me that my favorite queen, she has given birth to a daughter. That's why I feel so sad." Yeah, in India, daughters are not as good as sons. We want to have a son who can carry on the family lineage and these kind of things. And then the Buddha says to him, he says that a daughter can be just as good as a son. Yeah, it depends on how they live and what they do in their lives, and whether they kind of, and if a daughter lives better than a son, well, she is preferable to have than to have a son. So it is the wrong way to think. Yeah. And this is one of the first examples, I think, in human history where kind of the equality of opportunity kind of is brought out. You know, whether you are a man or a woman shouldn't be the main point. It is how you live your life and how you are as a person that really matters in the world. Irrespective of any of these kind of things that we divide ourselves into, male, female, rich and poor, educated, uneducated, from this nationality, that nationality, all of that is really quite irrelevant. It is how we are as human being that matters. That's kind of nice, isn't it? The Buddha as kind of an equal opportunity or non-discrimination teacher going back 2,500 years. This is another one where kind of the Buddha talks in a very ordinary way to ordinary people. The sort of thing you might think ordinary people talk about, and it makes the Buddha into an ordinary person just like the rest of us. There's another nice story from one of my favorite stories. Is from the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya is the discipline, code of discipline for the monastics. It talks about the rule that the monastics are supposed to keep. It also talks about the way that the Sangha, the Buddhist monastic community, is supposed to organize itself and sort out things and decide on things. And in there, there's a story about a monk who is very sick. He has dysentery. And dysentery is a very kind of filthy illness with kind of fluids and everything just flow through you. It's very kind of disgusting. And on this particular occasion, the Buddha walks through the monastery. And the Buddha walks from hut to hut, from monk to monk, and kind of looks about to see if everyone is okay. Yeah, the Buddha has compassion for his monastic disciples, looks after them, makes sure everything is okay. And then he comes to this hut of this monk who has dysentery. And then this monk is just lying there. And so the Buddha says to him, "Well, haven't you got an attendant to look after you?" And the monk says, "No. How come we haven't got an attendant?" "Well, it's because I don't do anything for the monks. They don't do anything for me." Kind of strange, isn't it? And then the Buddha says to Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda is the Buddha's attendant. He was with the Buddha for over 20 years. He says to Venerable Ananda, "Go and get some water and we will clean up this monk." Then the Buddha and Venerable Ananda together, clean him up, yeah, dress him in some fresh robes, nice new robes, and then lift him up by the head and feet and put him on the bed. Yeah, the Buddha, getting down really dirty, yeah, this is kind of disgusting stuff, dysentery, helps Venerable Ananda to clean up this monk who is sick in his cutie here. Kind of astonishing, the greatest spiritual master in human history here, and here he does all of these kind of things. But in many ways, to me, this is exactly what makes the Buddha a great spiritual master here, in the fact that he lives out the way he teaches, he acts the way he speaks. He's not just sitting on a pedestal, sitting on a high seat, kind of teaching and telling people what to do here. He actually lives the way that he teaches. And this is what is so powerful very often. When people do things in the right way, that is how they show that they really are worthy of that respect as a spiritual master sometimes should be worthy of. So then what happens next is that he does all of that, and then he, after having cleaned up this monk and put him on a bed, he goes out to the rest of the monks. And he says to the rest of the monks, well, is there a sick monk in that cutie? Yes, there is a sick monk there. How come no one here is looking after him? And the monks say, they say, he doesn't do anything for us, so we don't do anything for him. And the Buddha is not amused, as they say, the Buddha is not amused. Is that, can the Buddha not be amused? I guess he can. The Buddha is not amused. And the Buddha says that you don't have any mother and father. You don't have anyone to look after you. If you don't look after each other, who's going to look after you? And then he says that anyone who would look after me should look after each other within the Sangha. Yeah, anyone who would like look after me, you should look after each other in exactly the same way. In other words, looking after each other is actually something very beneficial and very useful, and something that you should do just to show that you care for each other and look after each other. So this is, again, the Buddha actually living the example and then telling the monks to look after each other in the same way as they would look after him. So these are just some examples to show you that Buddha was an ordinary human being. Yeah, just like everyone else. He was no different. When he got old later on in life, he was talking about his old age and how his faculties were deteriorating. You know what it's like when you're the oldest, you have to use glasses after a while. I'm using glasses now because I can't see, can't really read anymore without glasses at all, actually. Everything's a bit of a blur. So you can feel your faculties gradually deteriorating as you get older. And the Buddha talks about that, yeah, and towards the very end of his life, he has to lie down all the time and rest, he has to do all of these things that you would expect of someone who is getting very old, he's stooped, his skin is getting very wrinkled and all these kind of things. So the Buddha was an ordinary human being, and this is very important. It's maybe not so important in the West, but in very many traditional Buddhist countries, the Buddha gets put on the pedestal of God, or the pedestal of universal principle, or the pedestal of someone we pray to get a new BMW or whatever. Yeah, that's the kind of way you put the Buddha. It's the wrong pedestal. Yeah, actually the wrong one. You have to get the right pedestal. This is the right pedestal. This is the pedestal of the Buddha as perfected human being, which is different. Yeah, that is kind of the right pedestal. Someone who has taken the human potential to the highest. That is something we can all do. Yeah, we can all kind of take our own human potential to a very high level. So in that sense, he's only an example for all of us. But he's actually one of us. He's part of what it is to be a human being. So this is the first part. First thing that's very important to remember about the Buddha, because then when we relate to his teachings, we relate to a teacher who is teaching directly to us, somebody who understands our predicament, yeah, because he was in exactly the same predicament before his awakening. The Buddha talks about having defilements of the mind, yeah, being angry and these kind of things before his awakening. He talks about having wrong view, wrong ideas about reality. He had a wife and a child, yes. So basically, he was in very much in a very kind of standard human situation. He obviously had some very powerful spiritual qualities as well, but he also was a human being in an ordinary sense. And very useful to remember that. So when you ever, if you ever read any of these teachings by the Buddha, you can actually think of him as a teacher who understands us. Yeah, he understands the human predicament, the human situation. This is one side of the Buddha, very useful to keep in mind. But of course, there's something more. Yeah, if that was all he was, it wouldn't be all that interesting. There's got to be something more about the Buddha. So what is that more? And what that more is can be looked upon in a couple of different ways. The two qualities of the Buddha that sort of stand out and has always been talked about in Buddhist history. And those two qualities are, on the one hand, his wisdom, the wisdom faculty of the Buddha, and on the other hand, the compassion. Compassion and wisdom, two very important aspects of who the Buddha was. The wisdom faculty is talked about in different ways in the suttas, and one of these ways that it is talked about is as loka vidu. Loka vidu is a Pali word. It means one who knows the world, who understands the world. The word vidu is related to the English word wit. Ready wit, someone who's kind of sharp-witted. And loka means world, so someone who understands the world. What does that mean? And what that means, it means can be many different things. And one of the things that it means, of course, is the idea that the Buddha has an understanding of things like rebirth. Rebirth is one of the fundamental ideas of the Buddhist teachings. He has an understanding of the mechanism that drives rebirth, which is the laws of karma. So karma and rebirth, he understands. It can also be understood as meaning that he understands perhaps the universe, in a little bit like the sense we do now, perhaps, because he obviously has some very powerful faculties. It's a bit of a side issue, but certainly the idea of rebirth and certainly the extent of human society and all of that. So all of that is one way of thinking about loka vidu. But what it really, really means at the end of the day is that he has a full understanding of suffering and happiness. This is what it really means. Because to be able to fully understand happiness and suffering, you have to understand things like rebirth, because you have to understand, first of all, the full extent that is possible in the human situation, which is quite large. You can look at the humanity. Some people have incredible suffering in this world, and some people live in kind of fairly good lives. Some people are incredibly poor, living in war zones, what have you. Other people are kind of living in wealthy countries, and they may even be wealthy within the wealthy countries and all of that. There's quite a large spectrum within this world. But to fully understand that spectrum of happiness and suffering, you have to also to understand the idea of rebirth. Where might I be reborn? What are the potentials in terms of how bad it can be or how good it can be? And once you understand that, the whole potential for happiness and suffering within existence as a whole, only then can you start to understand the world. Why? Because happiness and suffering is what drives human beings. This is what we all desire. We want to move towards greater happiness, more contentment, more satisfaction, more of all these positive things. And we want to move away from the negative things in life. So happiness and suffering are the two things that are kind of at the root of what drives us to do almost everything that we do in life. This is the source of all the desires, the searching, the craving, the doing, the attachments, everything in the world that we kind of aspire towards, that is where it comes from. So if you have a full understanding of happiness and suffering, it means that you then have the ability to evaluate that happiness and suffering, to see how to move towards the happiness and away from the suffering, and you have a full understanding of that spectrum, and you know how to achieve the happiness and get rid of the suffering, you have actually understood what really is at the core of human existence, what we're all trying to achieve and what we're all trying to go. So basically, you have the key, the understanding to... This is not the key, this is something else. Is that it?
Yep.
Oh, wow, that's really quick. It used to be longer in the past. Okay, that's good. So, he has the key to what everyone is looking for. And for that reason, I always like to say, and I think this is no exaggeration at all, is that the Buddha has the answer to the very question of the meaning of life. That's what he has. And once you kind of get a feel for that, that he understands happiness and suffering, he has the answer to the very question of the meaning of life, then you also have some idea of what the wisdom of the Buddha is all about. It is the most profound wisdom that is possible to have of human existence. Because if you understand the meaning of life, well then, you have it all solved, really. So this must, by definition, be the highest kind of wisdom. It's a pretty amazing statement when you think about it, because the idea of the meaning of life is something that people and philosophers and religious people have thought about for millennia. And they always kind of end up, okay, too hard, and they just kind of put it to one side, because they can't solve it, Meaning of life, just too much. They kind of throw it out, put it in the rubbish bin, and think about something that is more thinkable, like physics or something like that instead, because that is kind of easy compared to the meaning of life. Meaning of life is too hard. And here comes this one man, and he claims to have discovered the very meaning of life itself. And that is kind of astonishing. Of course, this is not easy necessarily to grasp how he has discovered that, or why it actually works. And I would really recommend you to reflect on that, because if you get that, the idea that the Buddha actually has that insight, well then, I can guarantee you, you'll become incredibly committed to this path, because then you understand what it is all about. Once you feel that, you can't really do anything else. You can't chuck out the meaning of life and take up something else, take up shopping instead. That's kind of crazy, isn't it? If you found the meaning of life, well, you really have to pursue it. There's no choice anymore. You kind of become bound to that, because you have found something very beautiful and meaningful, and the only thing that really matters in this world. So this is the wisdom of the Buddha. There's another side to the Buddha, and this is the compassion side. And of course, once you understand that you have discovered the meaning of life, and you can see that everyone in the world is searching for this, everyone is trying to find a solution, trying to move away from suffering, trying to find more contentment and happiness, everything that drives us in our lives is basically about that. It's about trying to find these things that kind of gives us some deeper meaning and purpose and aim and all of these things. So once the Buddha understands that he has the answer that everyone is looking for, what happens? Compassion arises. You have compassion because you want to share this insight, this understanding with the people around you. It's the natural consequence of having that kind of understanding. So then the Buddha decides to teach, because he has this. But what is so powerful about this moment when the Buddha decides to teach is that it is a very different reason for teaching than almost any other teacher in the world has. The vast majority of teachers, they have some vested interest in teaching. You teach because you want to make a salary. You teach because, I can get really famous. You teach because if I go and teach, I can get some donations for my new monastery in wherever that is. I don't have a new monastery, by the way, so not to worry about that. you teach for, I don't know why, there can be all kinds of ulterior motives for teaching, not just to share the Dhamma or whatever it is that you're doing. And because of that, the teaching is never 100% pure. Perhaps you want to flatter the egos of your audience, because you think, if I flatter them, then they become more kind of generous or whatever. Or if you make a salary, you have to follow a certain curriculum or do things in a certain way, But for the Buddha, was actually not only was there not any vested interest, there was a negative vested interest. Because what the Buddha really wanted to do was just to chill. Isn't that right? He just wanted to relax. He just wanted to go to a cave and sit down, cross his legs, meditate really deeply, get into the jhanas, bliss out, and have a good time. That's what everybody wants. The Buddha was no different from everyone else in that sense. But instead of actually doing that, he then decides that he is going to teach humanity instead, precisely because he has this key to the very meaning of life. So he gives up his own happiness, at least to some extent. Now he can meditate much less, he can spend less time in caves, and he has to hang out with all these people, and sometimes those people are... be careful what I'm saying now. they are a nuisance, they are problematic, they ask stupid questions, they do all kinds of things, And sometimes they come to him and they just want to argue with him, and if you just want to argue, go away, I don't want to argue with you. And so this is how it is. So he gives up so much of what he could have had otherwise, just to be able to share with people. And there is no ulterior motive, because when you have no ego anymore, there's no ulterior motive in what you, how you relate to your disciples. So he does it purely from compassion. That's the only reason why a Buddha teaches. And that's very powerful. When you read the suttas, when you read of the word of the Buddha, if you ever do, simple things like things in the Dhammapada that, hate, you never overcome hate with hate. You only overcome hate by non-hate or by love in this world. This is an eternal law. When you read that, you know it is true, because it kind of just makes so much sense. If you send hate back to someone who hates, it just kind of escalates and often gets worse. But if you are cool about it and you don't really escalate it, then often you kind of defuse a tense situation and make it better. So whenever you read these beautiful teachings, whatever they are, remember the Buddha is always coming from compassion. Yeah, and what that does when you read those teachings and you know it's coming from compassion, it opens you up a little bit. It makes you more receptive to the teachings. And even if the teachings may sometimes be difficult, maybe sometimes you think, oh, this Buddha is asking too much. Yeah, he's asking us to kind of stop enjoying this and enjoying that, and we have to do these, kind of, we have to keep five precepts. I only want to keep three. Yeah, these two are too difficult, or whatever it is. Yeah, whenever you feel the Buddha is asking too much, open up your mind. Remember, he's coming from compassion. That's the only thing that is driving him. He's not trying to do anything else. He's doing this only so that your life and my life can be better. And when you read the suttas in that way, it has a very different effect on you. You become more open-minded, you become more willing to at least take things on board initially as a possibility, yeah, even if there are things you might find hard to believe straight away. And this opens up a new reality, a new possibility. And this is the one of the right ways of thinking about these teachings. So these are the two things that stand out for me when I think about the Buddha. The idea of wisdom, someone who has unlocked the very meaning of life, and compassion, so the teachings are very pure and very bright and done purely from the right place, the right kind of motivation. There is more though, and what is more is also has to do with the way we approach these teachings, the way we think about them, yeah, and what our relationship with the Buddha actually is in a more direct way. And one of the ways of thinking about this is to reflect on what the Buddha himself said about his teaching career as he started out 2,500 years ago. In the very first teaching of the Buddha is called the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, which means setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. Are you impressed by my Pali knowledge? It's pretty good, yeah? It's pretty cool, yeah? The thing is that if you say a few Pali words that nobody understands, you gain more authority, yeah? So this is the way I get authority if I sitting here. If I say a few Pali words, everyone is really impressed. Like, wow, that's really, really profound. So the Dhammacakka Pavattana, setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. And the point of this, the idea of setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, is that the wheel of the Dhamma is the teaching rolling out into the world. And the idea is that the rolling out in the world is the idea that these teachings, because they are so profound and people gain confidence and faith in them when they hear them, is that they carry on from one generation to the next one, one era to the next one, rolling on, yeah? And not only from generation to generation, era to era, but also from culture to culture. That's why we now have it in Australia, not only Australia, but the majority of the Western world now. Buddhism is very popular. It moves on everywhere. The only continent where there is no Buddhism, I think, is Antarctica. Apart from that, it's everywhere. And because there just aren't enough people in Antarctica to have Buddhists. So we have to convert to penguins or something like that. But So the Buddha had this idea when he started out, yeah, that this teaching is going to roll on out from one kind of people to another one, on and on for millennia into the future. So because he had this idea, he taught in such a way that actually people will be able to understand it. Yeah, he taught in a very general way, in a very non-culturally specific way, in a way that has to do really with just psychology, and human psychology is actually very much the same wherever you go in the world. We are pretty much the same. Yeah, we have our same kind of desires, we all want to be happy, we want to be at peace, we have similar kind of defilements and problems in life. We are essentially the same. Not everybody wants to hear that we are the same, but I think it's basically true. Yeah, at least that's my experience. When I travel around the world and I talk to people from all kinds of backgrounds and cultures, once you get to know people well, you realize we're basically all the same. So he taught in a very generic way that is applicable to everyone. In other words, what he did, he was thinking about the future. He was thinking about people coming to the Armadale group. Yeah. In 2,500 years, there people coming to the Armada group. Wow, I'm going to teach in a way so they too can understand the message. Okay, not quite that specific, but you get the idea. Yeah, he was thinking about the future. And so when he was giving a teaching to an audience, whatever group that was, he would have in mind not just the people in front of him, but also all the other people to which this teaching would be passed in the future. So when you read the word of the Buddha, when you take out the Dhammapada, whatever it is, and you read a few verses in this book, remember, this is the Buddha speaking to you. Yeah, he had this situation in mind 2,500 years ago. He's talking directly to each one of us, because each one of us actually was on the Buddha's mind. Anyone who's going to listen to these teachings in the future are my disciples, and I'm going to talk to them in such a way they can understand. So when you open this book and you read and you think the Buddha is talking to me, it is far more powerful. It is not just black print on a white page or pixels on a screen or anything like that. It's actually the Buddha keeping each one of us in mind. How can I bring this message across in a way that actually works? And when you read the suttas in that way, and you know they're coming from compassion, trying to help each one of us because he has the key to the very nature of existence, it starts to become extraordinarily powerful. It's like you get goosebumps. Yeah, you get kind of, your hair stands on end. At least for those of you who have a bit of hair. But yeah. And it's like, whoa, this is kind of, it actually makes it incredibly powerful. So how you relate to these teachings, how you think about them, how you kind of, the background sort of attitude you have to them actually makes a lot of difference in how you receive it, how you take it on board, and whether it actually gives you something special, like inspiration, for example, or any of these kind of things. So this is one of the attitudes I would recommend you to have in mind if you ever read these teachings. And in any case, if you come here to the Amara group, the kind of teachings that you get would be actually about the teachings of the Buddha anyway. There will be similar kind of things. Yeah, whenever I give a teaching, I always quote from the suttas in the word of the Buddha. So a lot of the things you may not realize it even, but a lot of the things I say are straight out of the Buddhist discourses. Another way of thinking about the Buddha, this is just an additional way of thinking about him, and that is to think about yourself as maybe approaching the Buddha. Yeah, imagine the Buddha sitting in India, and very often he would sit in the forest at the foot of a tree or something like that. So imagine yourself going into this forest. You know that the Buddha is there because you have been told that the Buddha is visiting the local village, yeah, the local village of Armadale, and now he's hanging out in the forest behind Armadale or something like that, or think about being in India or whatever it is. And then you walk into this forest, and you are about to meet the greatest spiritual master in human history. How do you feel? Feel a bit maybe a bit apprehensive, or a little bit kind of worried about this. It would be natural. Yeah, I remember the first time I came to a Buddhist monastery. I was really scared when I first time came to a Buddhist monastery. It's a long time ago now, 27-28 years ago, something like that. First time I came to a monastery, that was really, really frightening experience. And here you are, about to meet absolute pinnacle of spiritual mastery. That's the reputation. You don't really know, of course, but that's the reputation this person has. And you go into the forest, and you start approaching this person, and what you see is an ordinary man sitting at the root of a tree. He looks exactly like a monk. Yeah, he looks pretty much like this, actually. Yeah, except that his robes might have been slightly different, but very, very similar to what I look like today. And he looks like a monk sitting at the root of a tree. And he just seems very peaceful. Yeah, so you start to relax a little bit because it doesn't seem to be as very dangerous as you thought. And you go up to him, and the closer you get, the more you get this feeling of benevolence and peace coming from this person. It's as if this person is incapable of any kind of harm. This is the feeling you get when you get close to him. There's no ego there. There's no kind of a sense of personality clash or anything like that. There's a sense of complete acceptance. Because if there is no ego, there is no judgment of you or judgment of anyone else, and if you're not judged at all, you feel completely accepted. And if you are completely accepted by somebody, you really start to relax. Yeah, it is very often if you feel people judge us, we get a bit tense. But if someone really is completely non-judgmental, actually we relax in their presence. So you start to relax, and then you sit down. And then you ask your simple question. Yeah, you question about your family life. You feel a bit silly. Yeah, because you start to understand that this might be a special person. You feel a bit silly about having such a silly question. But even if your question is silly, he doesn't judge you. And he gives you a nice answer back. And the answer you get is very often very simple. It is not complicated. Yeah, a spiritual master often gives incredibly simple teachings. He says to you, be kind. Be generous. Don't judge other people. Yeah, and if you live these simple qualities in your life, you're going to go a long way on the spiritual path. all you really have to do is to be kind all the time. And if you're able to take that kindness with you at every instant in your life, wow, you're going to make such incredibly rapid progress on the spiritual path, because this is really the crux of what the spiritual path is about. And you take that kindness with you in everything you do, body, speech and mind and all of that, and then you sit down and you try to meditate. Bang! Your meditation is going to be so profound. It tells us something like that. Very, very simple. And because it is so simple, this is actually one of the qualities of being in the presence of a great spiritual master. And then you start to get this feeling of this profundity that is there. The profundity of wisdom, the profundity of peace, the profundity of acceptance, the profundity of all these good qualities. And when he's finished, all you want to do, you just want to bow down. You want to bow down because you understand that you have found finally something really worthy of bowing down to. There's something really special about this. So you bow down and you feel blissed out while you're bowing, because you understand that bowing to something profound and beautiful like this is incredibly worthwhile. You're actually bowing down to all these wonderful qualities. What a wonderful thing that is. And then you get up and you start walking away, and you realize you have found an incredible treasure in your life. And for that reason, you're able to take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and you carry this light with you. You carry these teachings with you. You carry that potential for coming back to these teachings and learning more about them for the future. Yeah, and then you have something in your life that is extraordinarily valuable, that always guides you in the right direction, always brings you in the right way, or coming from this encounter with this man in the forest, a very powerful and beautiful encounter. So this is how it all starts, and this is what we're kind of trying to do on the Vesak day, remembering who the Buddha is. Remember that extraordinary inspiration that he gives because of the incredible qualities that he has. This is why sometimes in Buddhism we kind of bow down even to a Buddha statue, because we remember those qualities that actually were there in this person that existed 2,500 years ago. And then we're building up a refuge for ourselves, a place we can go, a place we can hang out, a place we can always come back to resolve the problems in our life, and to give us inspiration to practice the spiritual path in an even more powerful way for the benefit of ourselves and also for the benefit of all people around us. Enough. Okay. So that's it. It's 2 minutes over, Doug. So anyway. So okay. Yeah.